So my name is Brett Littman. I'm the executive director of the Drawing Center, and tonight we're here to celebrate the book launch, which is actually really a compendium of a lot of the public programs that we did around Yannis Xenakis, composer, architect, visionary, co-curated by Sharon Kinnock and Carrie Lovelace. Probably one of my favorite shows that we've done at the Drawing Center, and one that we spent a lot of time working on, a lot of time together, and it's toured to four other venues around the world. I must say that probably in my tenure, it's the most talked about exhibition that we had done in the institution in about 10 years, and I think opened up a lot of interesting possibilities for the institution. I mean, I've always enjoyed contemporary music. I had met Xenakis at UC San Diego when I was in school. I was not a music student, but he had come there in 1990, 1991, and saw him perform at the Salk Institute, and it really made a lasting impression. That performance at the Salk Institute I remembered for many, many years, and I bumped into Carrie at the Venice Biennale in maybe 2007, and I asked her what she was doing afterwards, and she said, "I'm going to the Bibliothèque Nationale to look at some things in the archive about Xenakis." It turned out that you had studied with him, and then Sharon kind of came into the picture. And I think when you started sending me some images from that archive, immediately I said, I think we should make an exhibition. And that exhibition, as I said, was really essential. It also allowed us to collaborate with many, many, many different partners. I can't even remember. How many public programs do you think there were? 100? 3,000? I mean, it was endless. I mean, for the Drawing Center, I think we had about 20. But every other venue also made so many other public programs. And I think that since there's so little literature on Xenakis in English, all of the books that Pendragon has produced, that Sharon has worked on, our small catalog, which is also available upstairs, really has added to the scholarship. I have to say that since our exhibition, it seems that Xenakis is on the minds and tongues of many more people in the U.S. In Europe, there was always discussion, but I think it's really opened up, not only in the music world, but to the art world as well. And that was one of our goals. So now I want to introduce Sharon, who's going to lead the rest of the evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Brett. And thank you all for coming out tonight. Just very briefly, as you have seen perhaps this lovely postcard that my niece, Becky, has designed, we have a great lineup tonight with Joel Chatterby, David Lieberman, Carrie Lovelace, my co-curator, Robert Rowe, Ronald Squibbs, and originally Robert Black was supposed to come and play Therops for us tonight, but unfortunately Robert fell down 15 stairs and is in pretty bad shape. But we have a marvelous pinch hitter, Conrad Harris, who will be playing tonight Mika and Mika S by Xenakis. Also, as well. Xenakis Matters, the book that we're launching tonight, is the sixth volume published by Pendragon Press since 1985. The first book that we did was Art Sciences Alloys, and it was an interesting story because Xenakis kind of dared me to translate this, and I was, you know, just kind of a young musician and not that proficient, I didn't think, in French. But, you know, you're 22 years old and Xenakis is Xenakis and you don't say no to the guy. And so, you know, I thought everybody loved Xenakis as much as I did. So I, you know, wrote to Norton and I wrote to Oxford and I wrote to all the mainstream presses. And all of the rejection slips started trickling in. Except there was one quiet note on the side from Norton, signed by Miss Claire Brooke, who suggested that it's a very worthy project, but it was something that wasn't for Norton, but I should try Pendragon Press. So Pendragon Press, this is before the internet, I wasn't quite aware of who they were, but did my homework and submitted the manuscript to Pendragon Press, and lo and behold, had a contract by return mail. It was only many, many years later, after, I would say, in the late 90s, Claire was the vice president and music editor at Norton until 1992, but she was also the founding member of Pendragon Press with her husband, Barry Brooke. back in the 70s when Barry had the same problem I was having with the Xenakis book, meaning you couldn't find a publisher. And yet it was in demand, and so Claire and Barry had produced this book together and created this company to do that. And now here we are, you know, in 2013, and the catalog is over 400 books. And it was really Claire's initiative that we sort of up the ante a little bit about the Pendragon's commitment to Xenakis, and we created this Xenakis series. So the first two books, Art, Sciences, Alloys, and Formalized Music, his seminal sort of theoretical writings, happened before that. When Claire came onto the scene, then it started getting much more serious with the Xenakis series, with music and architecture first, then performing Xenakis, then opening it up to third. And performing Xenakis was the first venture, very much motivated by Claire, to get other people to talk about Xenakis. Xenakis died in 2001, and so it was, we could open it up to third-party literature. And so Performing Xenakis is a collective volume with 30 participants from all the different families of instruments to who sort of give the tricks of the trade to perform some of this quote-unquote impossible music that's among the most recorded and some of the most performed music, despite the reputation of it being so difficult. And so, as Brett mentioned, in the five legs of the show, Yannis Xenakis, Composer, Architect, Visionary, in the three North American venues, here in New York, partnering with Brooklyn Experimental Media Center, in Montreal with the Kermit, which is the Center for Interdisciplinary Media Technology Research, something like that, and in LA with CalArts, we were able to host symposium for around Xenakis each time. And I was absolutely flabbergasted by the quality and the variety of materials that were presented in each of these three things, and would come back to New York each time and tell Claire very excitedly about how wonderful some of this stuff was, and very different from anything that you normally hear in these symposia in Europe. And Claire, without batting an eyelid, just would say, "We're not doing proceedings." So, you know, it was up to me at that point. She said, "That doesn't mean we're not going to do a book. Up to you to figure out how to do a book." So from that, I kind of went back to the source, and I went back to some of Yannis's writings, and I found something that he had produced in music, formalized music, which is a mosaic of coherences. And this mosaic of coherences, it's just a small, tiny document where he really works out kind of a schema of what he pleads for as being creative knowledge. And this idea of creative knowledge was exactly what I was witnessing in the three different symposia. And so tearing that mosaic apart a little more, I saw that we could really divide the book into three main chapters: context, procedures, and applications. Because there were a lot of artists who were emerging also who were very, very much influenced by Xenakis and taking his ideas and his concepts to the next step. So I submitted this to Claire, and she thought that it could work under the condition that all of the authors of the papers in these very, very scholarly contexts would rewrite it in order to rewrite their contributions in order to fit into this context, which everyone very generously and very willingly did. Unfortunately, in the month of June, right in the heat of all of this, Claire passed away. And this is why I would like to make this evening kind of a tribute to Claire also, because without her, the book wouldn't have been here. Without her, perhaps the Pendragon and Xenakis series wouldn't even exist. And so I really would like to just render homage and a tribute to Claire and her perseverance, her patience with me. She's the world's best editor. I feel like an orphan without her. But we'll try to keep things going at Pendragon in her memory and in her light. And voila, that's it. So all five books, six books, are available upstairs. They all have the launch discount of 10%. And there are some perusal copies in the back, which you're more than welcome to bruise. And so now I would like to pass it on to Joel, who has some memories to share with us.
You know, Xenakis was trained as a civil engineer. And so he was very interested in what we might call underlying complexity. Civil engineers were dealing with probabilistic ways of dealing with large numbers of molecules moving in heat-producing systems and so on. And his life was shaped, for one thing.
Can you cut a little bit, Joel?
Sure. His life was... Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'll use the... How's that? His life... Xenakis' life was shaped, for one thing, by being a civil engineer. But I, and so he did have certainly a look at heat-generating systems and gas systems and so on, and talked about statistical movements of large numbers of small objects. In fact, he talked about them quite a bit. Even in his personal life, he talked about, as a young person, going camping up in northern Greece and hearing the drops on the tent and what a wonderful sound that was, and the cicadas and so on. And he was, later on in life, he often referred to the violence of a military world or combat world and crowds and machine gun fire and so on in Athens, talking about the sounds that crowds make, but all very often talking about numbers of things that make up a cloud of sound. Now, having said that, that's not entirely what I'd like to say here this evening. What I'd like to talk about this evening is something that's sort of in parallel with that, which is a little bit about his life. It's my guess, just a guess, that I probably, of all of you here tonight, have known Xenakis for the longest period of time. I met him in 1964 in Berlin, and we were both there together for that year, and we kind of hit it off. I was a very young guy, and so he was, of course, not exactly old, and I remember that I had shared an apartment with another composer that some of you might know, Frederick Shevsky, who was very often out of town, and I used to have parties all the time and throw dinners. I had lived in Rome the year before Berlin, and we used to go out to dinner a lot in Rome. But when I came to Berlin, I found that there were no really good Italian restaurants in 1964, so I learned how to cook pasta myself and had people over for dinner. And Xenakis was a visitor, often visitor. In fact, I remember being a little bit surprised that he often had bread with spaghetti. But the point is that I got to know him, and after Berlin, he moved, of course, we went back to Paris, and I was at that time in Paris maybe 4 or 5 times a year during probably 20 years, and often saw Xenakis at that time. So we'd go out to lunch, and I'd visit him in the studio, and we'd talk about his music and various things of that sort, and got to know him as a very non-pretentious, very straightforward, interesting person. And we sort of accumulated a very, really very nice friendship. Towards the 1990s, when I was writing a book on the history of electronic music, I contacted Xenakis more often than I had before. I had, in fact, gone to Paris to see him and to spend a great deal of time with him. And when I said, hey, let's meet in your studio and I want to ask you some questions, he said, oh my God, how long will it take? And I said, well, maybe 2 or 3 hours. He said, 2 or 3 hours. Well, we were there for a very long time, in any case. And we visited his studio at Issy-les-Moulineaux, just outside of Paris, where he was developing, at that point, some of his computer projects. He had already done the UPIC system several years earlier. So in this case, really what it was a kind of probabilistic approach towards, in the time domain, that is, towards changing a waveform. It's kind of interesting. And he demonstrated that, and he asked me what I thought of his assistants and were they doing their job and stuff like that. But we had some very interesting times, and he told me a lot about the way he was thinking about things. Now, having In fact, it was about that time that I was in Paris. I called Yanis, and he said, hey, come on over to lunch. And when I went over there, there was Sharon. And that was the first time we had met, but it turned out that Sharon and I had a very similar background. I mean, when I was teaching at Bennington College for a few years, many years ago, she was a student, although she never took my course. but nonetheless, there was that, and we just very, very comfortably became good friends, really, very, very, very quickly. But about Yanis, there was all of that that I'm saying, a lot of very pleasant times. I was at his home for dinner very often during that period, and talked to him really quite a bit. We had lunches together and spent quite a bit of time with him. I began to understand Yanis, a very complex person, after he died, more in reflecting. So it's true that many of us react that way to friends, that we don't really see a bigger picture until after someone dies. But I did begin to realize a lot of things about Zanocki's life that colored his life. Well, certainly being an engineer and dealing with a lot of little things and how they make a large cloud of things happen is typical of civil engineering and so on. But Zanocki's was also, and if anything, more driven by his war experience. Now, I think Zanocki's was in the resistance when he was about 20, 22 years old. So he was born in 1922, so in early 1940, how old was he at that time? He was a pretty young guy. And he started by being in a rightist battalion during the Second World War, was Greek resistance, and then changed to a leftist battalion when the Germans fought. And at the same time, attended the Athens Institute of Technology, which was not open all the time, but sporadically open. So he was studying at that time. When the Germans and Italians left, the British came in, and the British were very interested in reinstalling a monarchy in Greece. And Yanis was again in the resistance, throwing things at British tanks. And he was, in fact, at the age in his early 20s, he was in charge of the so-called Lord Byron Battalion. He was sitting in a house with some friends, and a British tank fired into the house, and the round exploded very close to Zanocki's, blowing away half his face and an eye and an ear. And his father, who was a pretty well-to-do businessman, had him in a hospital, and Zanocki's lived through that really very well. Finished his degree at that time at the Institute of Technology in Athens, became a certified civil engineer, and apparently a very good one, and then was given a false passport by his father to go to New York. So on his way to New York, he stopped in Italy, and he saw, I guess, people at the French consulate who recognized, the consul recognized that it was a false passport, but let him in anyway. It was after the war. And the reason he did that, the reason he had to leave so quickly, was because all the members of the resistance, the British had succeeded in installing a very conservative government, and the government was looking for all the resistance workers and putting them in jail and killing them. And so Zanocki's left for fear of his life and went through Rome, got to Paris, en route to New York. But in Paris, as he told me, he said, well, I stay there, why not? And he did stay there, and he met, through an acquaintance, he very shortly met Le Corbusier, who was at that time one of the leading architects. Now, Le Corbusier, this was post-war, was extremely interested in how to rebuild Europe, and he came up with a formula called the modular. The modular was something like the Fibonacci series, where every number is the sum of the previous two, and he was at that time working on l'habitation de
Marseille.
It's à l'unité d'habitation, so that's what it was called. It's a large building, and Zanocki's did some work on that. It is a stunning building in Marseille, actually. A friend of mine has a studio there, and it is really unusual and really remarkable, because with the Fibonacci series and every number is being the sum of the previous two, you can have a room that's 8 meters long. You can have a room that's... Sorry, okay. Right. So with the Fibonacci series, you can have a room that's 8 meters wide and divided into two sections of 5 and 3 and so on. And it, those proportions just seem to work out beautifully. But in any case, then he worked, his next project was La Tourette, as I recall, which is not a monastery, but it's
a convent.
It's a convent just outside of Lyon. And really quite remarkable, and it's kind of typical of Zanucki's. It's a square with an internal courtyard, and in one side of the square is a church, and on either side of the church there are tubes that face up towards heaven. On one side there are three, and on the other side six or so, and Zanucki's call them the cannons of heaven, and the others the mitraillette, the machine guns that I'm using very often, this kind of war language. And I think that, and Zanucki's did mention to me that he was very propelled forward, that he was interested not just in a career, but in a big career, that he wanted to accomplish big things. And of course that really didn't make sense to me particularly, or at least I didn't interpret that in any particularly important way. I thought that it was kind of interesting that in his particular ambition. But as I realized much later, I think that it was a kind of survivor's guilt, and that he really felt that to justify his having left Athens just at a time when many of his friends and colleagues back in Athens were in fact caught by the prisoned by the government and shot, that he was that he had in fact escaped and had a great life, and that he felt that one way of justifying that was in doing a lot of really very good things. So he was very much propelled forward by that. When he got to Paris, after he worked for Le Corbusier very successfully for a couple of years, he decided to really take up, well, you could say resume, but he hadn't really studied music very seriously before that, but he decided to take up a career in music. And his approach clearly was not one based on fugues and exercises in four-part harmony and so on. In any kind of traditional sense, it was based on largely on mathematics. And so he looked around for someone to study with in Paris, and came across a friend of, now I'm forgetting the names.
Messiaen.
It was, well, he ended up with Messiaen, yeah. And he, so he went to see Messiaen at the Paris Conservatory, and Messiaen, after Zanucki's had been turned down by Honegger and various other people, he talked with Messiaen. Messiaen accepted him. Well, he accepted him as a student. He said, you know, I would always say that a composer has to study harmony and counterpoint. But in this case, you're 30 years old, you know what you're doing, you know math. Go ahead and do what you're doing and come to my seminar. And so Zanucki's, during the year of 1952, attended Messiaen's seminar really very often. And I have just thought that Messiaen probably felt that way about Zanucki's. But this is when I sort of put on my historian's hat and I make suppositions. And I think that at that time, Messiaen, when he did the quartet for The End of Time, did it in a German prisoner of war camp. And it was a rather stunning situation. The commandant of that particular camp had set Messiaen aside, given him music paper, given him the tools, and that it was written for instruments that were available at the camp and at the performance when it was played. It was everyone, and that prisoner of war camp was required to go, and it was such a stunning piece that the commandant of the camp gave Messiaen a passport to go directly back to France, just to leave. And Messiaen did and went back. And I think that Messiaen, my guess is that Messiaen shared Zanucki's war experiences just enough to have a great deal of sympathy for that and sort of step aside and try and make things more available for Zanucki's. But I think that's a kind of interesting take on his life as a whole. And the remarkable courage and intelligence that's shown in his music, because it is so utterly different from anything conventional in the music world, that he found very unusual champions for what he was doing. And all of his music, in one way or another, seems to reflect some kind of an underlying complexity, very much as the civil engineer would sort of interpret those kinds of thoughts into music, something going all the way back to, you know, his little kind of interlude for the Philips Pavilion in the Brussels World's Fair in 1958, called Concrete Péage, that it's made up of smoldering charcoal, but really there was no way of creating that kind of complexity in sound before that. So what he did is simulate it. He achieved a kind of result by some very clever way of doing what was, in fact, available in Pierre Schaeffer's studio at the time in Paris. I think that's pretty much what I would say about Yannis, at least in this context. So thank you.
Xenakis Matters. Thank you, Claire Brook. Thank you for your articulate wisdom. Thank you, Pendragon Press. Xenakis Matters. The limits of architectural space are set by the physical constraints of containment and are more often than not defined by the dimensional register of a visually perceived and conventionally accepted system of measurement and representation. The proposition rests in the assertion that oral perception is a more intuitive and natural means by which we both perceive and occupy spatial constructs. In an appreciation of both conscious and unconscious recognition of distance and dimension, volume and proportion, and material resonance, it is the oral which critically identifies the emotive qualities of architecture in its expanse and in its intimacies. Material resonance responding to the choreographic movement through space, complete with moments of pause and the frictions of engagement with others, is registered through sound, or rather acoustics, and must be a fundamental principle of design, conception, and development of an architectural idea. The music of architecture is evident in its articulate resolution. For Xenakis Matters. The discussion is situated in the context of the work initiated by Yannis Xenakis as foundational to architectural composition in investigating materiality, visual tactility, and orality as vital components of the imagining, bounding, and containment of space. Xenakis is the threshold of departure for consideration of spatiality in its resolution and form, but also in its occupation, tenancy, and use. The temporality of experience is permanent in its mimetic register. The insistence of the acuity of perceptions in the compositions and constructions of Xenakis brings to bear a richer set of opportunities to take pleasure in the intelligence and the emotions of the spaces in which we dwell. Xenakis sets a model for not only for integrated practice, but also a model for integrated pedagogy within the academy as projective and speculative research seeking to define space through its instrumentality and performity. Performance, performity, performativity, performance, for Xenakis Matters. Yannis Xenakis employed mathematics as a means to structure thought and composition, searching for a reductive, spare, and articulate voice with which to address classical philosophical reasoning. The music in the installations initiated considerations of spatial discourse as fundamental strategies. Mathematics was the threshold of departure, geometry is the discipline of its development. With the advent of technological innovations in computation and fabrication, architecture can engage and propose new paradigms. Music and acoustics generate the clarity of pure sound. It is the sound which punctuates the choreographed occupation of the space and most eloquently gives it meaning, for Xenakis Matters. Contemporary practice and compositional form are no longer of necessity evolved in a relationship to sight and are often situated in what is more appropriately described as virtual landscape. As form evolves in the shifting territories of an ephemeral ether, Architecture becomes an experiment in identifying parameters in terms of spatial dimension and quality through drawing and through digital scripting in order to understand both oral and visual performity. Space and an understanding of one's perception of place within it need not be defined by the boundaries of physical containment. Issues of perceptual acuity and relational perception set the limits of territory and have begun to suggest possible occupations. Arguably, the intensity of visual and oral information destabilizes and defamiliarizes the observer, the listener, and the viewer, setting forth the need for a new set of conditions to establish a sense of location and questioning the need for grounding. The fluidity or variability of context becomes apparent in the sea of sound. For Xenakis matters. Architecture needs to define or set the limits of its capacity for accommodation of tenancy and program. An architecture with a clarity of observation and specificity of perception may, in fact, permit the development of a new and unpredicted manifestation of the containment of space and of desire. Architecture that arises from consideration of the oral in its initial conception will produce not only a clearer understanding of space, but allow for an exploration of the materiality and tectonic convention by which the space is bound. Xenakis matters. Musical expression invites improvisation. The score is never played the same way twice in its constant variations on a theme and in its juxtapositions, be they harmonic or discordant. It is, in fact, the space between the notes. The experience of that music is not unlike the variations on a theme in architecture, in that in each time we move through a space, we move at a different pace, and our perceptions of that space are understood in the moments of reflective pause. Essential to an understanding of space in architectural composition are the elements of the details of assemblage. The metaphorical conditions of painted and constructed landscape afford a series of opportunities for access, intervention, and punctuation. Spaces are perceived as we move through them. Views are framed, and transitions are mediated. Listen. Listen intently to substance and materiality. Listen. Listen intently, for in listening we discover and we find meaning in the space and in the place of architecture. Thank you, Yannis Xenakis, for enticing me to architecture. Thank you, Sharon Canuck, for challenging me to continue to reflect on its possibilities. For Xenakis matters.
I think I'm on the screen. I think. All right. Oh, there we go. Thank you.
Second.
Thanks. That's perfect. So, wow, that's a crowd. So, it's so great to be here today and to share this wonderful book with everyone, and to just even to be here in the presence of Sharon and so many people who've been on this incredible journey that I've been on over the past 7 years, just being involved with Sharon and Sharon's knowledge and love and championing of this great figure, Xenakis. I've been in the art world for the last decades, but originally I was a composer of avant-garde music. And long ago, much longer than I want to even talk about, I was sitting in a cafeteria at the Darmstadt Music Festival, and this young woman bounced up and sat down at the table, and she was sort of introduced as this child prodigy who was studying with Nadia Boulanger, and that was Sharon Canuck, our esteemed editor and author. And I was very intimidated by her, as we all were, because she was, a child prodigy and studying with Nadia Boulanger and composing amazing music. And the next time I saw her was I walked into a class in Paris to the composer Yannis Xenakis was teaching, and there was Sharon Kanak, the child prodigy, was studying with Nadia Boulanger. Well, she was still pretty young at this time. Sharon, as anyone who knows her, is a person of boundless enthusiasm, the most generous person in the world, and she put me in touch with Olivier Messiaen. I began to study in his class and kind of connected me with an endless number of people. I ended up, leaving Paris, where I was living at the time, where I got to know Sharon, moving to New York, getting involved with the art world. But the time with Xenakis, obviously made a huge imprint on me. The thing I remember of Xenakis was of him sitting in his, standing in his classroom, which was really just like a classroom, with this big chalkboard, and he would like write things in sort of different colored chalk, because he was, kind of expressing the different dimensions that sound could happen on. And, I didn't actually understand a thing that he was talking about, but, what I did get from that was sound as a physical and a visual entity, that you could express compositional ideas in a sort of visual form. And actually, as a composer at that time, it was very inspiring, and I began actually to use visual means to stimulate my own compositions. So years later, somehow Sharon and I have kept in touch with all the other people that fall away and then, re-enter your life. And we were sitting in a cafe in Tribeca called La Petite Abeille. All right, so here's my origin story. Brett told his origin story, but my origin story was I was sitting with Sharon, who was visiting me from Paris, where she had had started to work with Xenakis over the years and become really a specialist in his work. He had died. She had translated his works, and she was telling me that she was going through his papers in the Bibliothèque Nationale, and she said, these things are like, you couldn't believe it. These are treasures. They're visually unbelievable. You've got to see what they are. And I said, maybe we should stage an exhibit. Now, I had never curated anything. I don't know, what I was thinking, and I think my initial idea was something in a little college gallery or something like that. Although I have to say my dream idea was maybe the drawing center could do it. That was my, but that was like a total fantasy. And so Sharon said, well, why don't you come to Paris and look at before we do this exhibit, you should look at these drawings. So, so I was at the Venice Biennale on the way to see Sharon, and I ran into Brett, and I said, I'm going to go look at these drawings. And Brett said, this is exactly what I want to do at the drawing center. But I thought that was really just a pipe dream, because it was such an amazing place. So I saw the drawings. They were incredible. And then I began to craft these little timid proposals to people, because I'd never put together a proposal for a show. And then Brett said, I really think we should do this thing at the drawing center. And little did he know what he was getting into at that point. So, this exhibition, blossomed into an amazing enterprise and really changed my life. And actually, the thing that was amazing about it, I mean, luckily I had curated a few shows by the time we actually did this, thank God, but I learned a lot on the job, and as Brett will attest. But
Now you're curating the Venice Biennale.
Thank you. But the thing that the other part of it that was amazing was working with Sharon. With Sharon, if you put a little seed of an idea out, let's do a party. Next thing you know, 18,000 people will be invited. The New York Philharmonic will be playing, and it will go on for 2 weeks at a time. It wouldn't be a multi-part traveling feast. So, and that was exactly what happened here. I mean, it was incredible, the partnership that we, put together between Brett, the Drawing Center, Sharon, and then Joel and EMF. And EMF, and many other partners that came in and staged just incredible events here. We did a virtual reality recreation of the Phillips Pavilion. We did concerts. The Jack Quartet came and performed. I mean, it was there were things that were just so moving. And the thing that was impressive to me was the way that this had an impact on the art world. Most artists had no idea who Xenakis was. They knew some composers like, you know, Stockhausen, a couple of people, but Xenakis had really fallen out of public notice. And I think the idea, first of all, just of his music, but then he actually, his visual output was just overwhelming, really, in a lot of ways. And I used to joke with Sharon that it was the gift that keeps on giving, because every time you discovered one thing, there was still another discovery. I mean, first of all, there was the architectural component, which I really did not understand at the outset how pivotal he had been in the world of architecture. That, you know, the Phillips Pavilion had brought in innovations in terms of the ways that buildings can be structured, in terms of the kind of hyperbolic paraboloid structure of roofs, the La Tourette that Joel was talking about. There are these innovations that architects around the world really cherish that I had no idea about. His use of drawing to express sound in so many different ways is just phenomenal. It's like a whole new way of thinking about the relationship, how sound can be expressed beyond notation. I mean, he was just brilliant, and there's just, you know, epic novels that could be written about on that subject alone. And then finally, the idea of performance, the idea of sound as a linear entity in space was just, you know, was a huge discovery that we began to explore here in terms of these multimedia polytopes that Xenakis crafted all over the world. When we were when we staged this at LA MoCA, we recreated one of Xenakis's polytopes. And by polytopes, these were like, I mean, polytopes meaning kind of means many sites is what it means, but actually they were sound and light events, which kind of diminishes what they were in a sense. But they were, you know, Xenakis's abstract sound combined with light as an abstraction in physical space, expressed with the physical intensity of sound that he created. And when we staged this polytope, De Persepolis, in Los Angeles, which had originally been staged in Iran, I understood, as I never had before, what Xenakis was trying to do in a lot of his music and in these polytopes, which is just the pure physicality of sound kind of grabs you. And Joel was talking about this too, about the you know, the wartime references that he made, but this idea of sound as a physical, dramatic, just passionate, taking you, filling you from the top to the bottom and shaking you. And you really have no way of grasping that unless you really experience that. And that was such a treasure. And again, Sharon brought together so many people to participate in this. So, you know, I think that I'm so pleased that rather than to have this, you know, I could stand obviously all night and just talk about this. Luckily, I won't. But you know, instead of letting this multifaceted experience just fall by the wayside, that Sharon took all the many components of it and put it in a book. You know, we also organized all of these many conferences in different places with incredible papers and interviews and videos, and Sharon put these together in this volume to commemorate this epic experience, but also the many levels of Xenakis' thought. And it was, such a tribute. You could not have a better friend, and Xenakis could not have a better friend, and neither could Claire Brook, because I think, you know, Sharon has been such a supporter of her also, as much as she felt that Claire was a supporter of her. Sharon was there for Claire through thick and thin, and is also continuing Claire's legacy too. So I just am so grateful that this happened, and here we are, 2007, 2013, a book, Drawing Center, Venice Biennale, and just thanks to everyone.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here. My name is Robert Rowe. I may be the person who knew Xenakis personally the least, but certainly was engaged with him on many levels kind of throughout my life. Lived in Europe from 1978 to 1987, and often came into contact with him, met him several times, but wasn't close to his work, but was involved in many levels, for example, with the Asco Ensemble, where we at one point recreated the Philips Pavilion and performed Concrepeage all around Holland. There's two just short anecdotes I want to relate about his work. One is that probably the most remarkable New Music concert. I mean, it's one of the starkest memories I'll ever have of a New Music concert that I talk about in the chapter, was at the Venice Biennale, where he was having an orchestral work performed. And it was this fantastic old church. There were a lot of people there. I somehow got in with my friends, and we were seated waiting for the concert to begin. But there were a number of people who didn't get in. It was sold out, more than sold out. And the carabinieri were closing the door against all these people who wanted to still get into the concert, one of whom was Xenakis. So there's all these people on the other side of the door, and you know, usually you close the doors and that's the people who give up and go home or whatever, but they kept pushing. So we're inside watching this door kind of shake as everybody on the other side is pushing the door, and the police are really holding it like this, standing there against the door holding it. And finally we're overwhelmed. They had to let the door open. These people streamed in to hear the concert. I mean, I've been to sold-out New Music concerts, but I never before, nor I'm sure never again, will I see where people literally beat the doors down to see this concert. It was really quite an amazing thing. Certainly knew a lot of people. I lived in Paris, was working at IRCOM, knew a lot of people who were working at Semamu, who had great familiarity with that system. What I talk about in the chapter are kind of the co-cursors, the precursors, and the post-cursors of Xenakis' work. So, in terms of algorithmic composition, is a field I've done quite a bit of work in. That I've worked quite a bit with Gottfried Michael Koenig, and then talking about his approach to algorithmic composition with respect to what Xenakis did, and so forth. To looking at using drawing as a way to articulate musical sound and form that he did with the Upik, but then has echoes in some of the work that Mort Subotnick does, or that Mary Farboud does. When I was at the other anecdote I'll relate was being at the MIT Media Lab, where I went there when I finally left IRCOM, got there in 1987, and we had this Bösendorfer Imperial Concert Grand Piano that was hooked up to solenoids. Back in 1987, this was still a rather unusual thing to have access to. So the Imperial goes down to a low C. So it's a beautiful instrument, and you could play it with these solenoids. So first thing I wanted to do as a doctoral student there was program it to play Herma, and make it play all the notes at tempo. So I was doing this demo of the piano playing Herma, and it's playing along, and then suddenly you see actually smoke rising from the piano as the solenoids are shorting out, trying to keep up with playing this. I could go on. Just the points in which I've been touched by Xenakis' work, from watching Steve Schick sit in a room playing Zappa over and over again for hours and hours and hours at the University of Iowa back in the late 70s, to his performance of that work. There are many examples of it, but I guess I'll just close by thanking Sharon. I kind of came into speaking at this symposium through tangentially almost relating a number of these stories, and she really convinced me and actually did quite a bit of the work in helping me to get it down on paper and really trying to pull together these ideas of how I think that Xenakis has had such a profound effect on everything that happens, even if it's not directly an expression of his own work, the influences that he's had and the relationships that he's had to so many things that have happened in the musical world before and since. So I really want to thank Sharon for encouraging me to do this, and congratulations on a wonderful work.
Good evening. I'm Ron Squibbs. I teach at the University of Connecticut, and I want to thank Sharon for including me in this project and inviting me to speak. I came to Xenakis' music as a graduate student at Yale looking for a dissertation topic, and what was going on then was analysis of modernist masterworks, mainly of the first half of the 20th century. And I did have some colleagues there at Yale who were wishing to extend some of the perspectives that scholars were developing on music of the first half of the 20th century to composers such as Ligeti, Lutosławski, and in my case, Xenakis. And I guess, well, I'm 50 years old now, so I can say in my generation, there seemed to be this idea, perhaps a utopian one, that of course it's wonderful the things that people are discovering about the structure of modernist music, and people would want more and more of this, of course, and especially at universities, including those, of course, in North America. And it seems to me that I very much enjoyed working on Xenakis' music, and I've tried to be faithful to the spirit of what was going on in North American music theory. And it hasn't had that big an audience, though. My work hasn't, or work on music from the second half of the 20th century within the North American music theory community, which seems to have taken a somewhat conservative turn. Some of the work that is being done is... it makes use of mathematical models, but focuses its attention a lot of the time on concert works of the 19th century and a few works from the beginning of the 20th century. So in certain respects, it's been wonderful to work on Xenakis' music. It's been very fulfilling for me. It's been, in some respects, good in terms of an academic career, because I get to go to international symposia, and that looks good to people in various places around the United States where I've taught, whether or not they really understand what, you know, what you talked about there, or understand how much fun it is to get together with just a plurality of people that gather around Xenakis' music. And so some of the memories that I have are just... random things that have happened, or anecdotes or remarks that were made at some of these symposia that in some respects maybe are more interesting to me than the technical aspects of the work that I've done on Xenakis' music, although that has been rewarding for me as well. But one anecdote, one situation that I remember was that at the first Xenakis symposium that I went to, which was in Paris in 1998, there was a presentation, there were some speakers and also some performances and some excerpts of recorded music at Radio Paris, and Xenakis was there. He was present in the auditorium for portions of this symposium, and so he was fielding some questions that were coming to him from people on the stage, and somehow the topic came up about his late music and why the dynamics seemed to be fortissimo and fortissimo almost all the time. And I think people were looking for a very deep philosophical reason for this. And he said, "It's because I'm going deaf." And that really stuck with me, because one of the pieces that I heard an excerpt of at that presentation was Etidra for string sextet, which is basically double stops for a string sextet uninterruptedly for maybe 8.5 minutes or something, I don't know exactly how long it is, fortissimo. And the sounds were just so overwhelming. But I had to wait for a number of years until that came out on CD. And somehow I happened to have the score to that in my studio when I was working on the article that's included in the book, which is mainly about metastases. And somehow, fortuitously, I noticed what seemed to be some connections between the works. Again, it may be entirely fortuitous, but some of the chords with which that late work begins are similar in some respects to some of the boundaries of the sound masses that were used at the end of Metastases. And so I have to say that this working on this project, developing the talk that I had for the article that's in the book, and participating in the symposia in New York and in Montreal has really it's re-stimulated my interest in working on Xenakis, because I had been working on some other things. And so I think I really want to follow. I know, I'm bad. Very bad. I shouldn't say that, but it happens sometimes. But so I do feel kind of refreshed and re-stimulated because of the plurality of voices in this book. I was happy to have participated in the events in New York and in Montreal, but didn't make it out to L.A. And so I do want to get back to that late string piece. Because another thing that happened at one of the symposia I went to, this one was in Guelph and general Toronto area. I remember there was one restaurant in town near the University of Guelph where everybody seemed to congregate, and had big long tables. And Gerard Pape was there, who at one time had been the director of the Simamu, which then became, what was it called, a CC Mix after that, and now it's the Centre Yanis Xenakis, yeah. But he was talking about Xenakis' illness toward the end of his life, of which I had been unaware, and the book that that Xenakis' now widow, Françoise Xenakis, had written about her experiences at the end of Xenakis' life. So I started looking at that and thinking about the late music in those terms, because somewhat during that period, just in my own personal life, my mother had developed malignant brain cancer, and so it was a 5.5 year journey of dealing with that, treatments that were successful for a while, and then the ultimate, the final course that things took. And during that time, it was really the late music of Xenakis, and also late music of Cage and Feldman and stuff, was really kind of appropriate to what I was going through, which was unprecedented, of course, in my experience, and not something that could easily be talked about, in the hallways of academia. I guess not. So I look forward to exploring that music further and seeing where that takes me. Thank you very much, Sharon.
So this is the performance part of the evening. I'd like to wish Robert Black all the best. He was going to be here and perform Theraps, a beautiful piece for bass solo, but he injured himself, fell down the stairs, something. And so I'm filling in, and I'm going to play the two pieces that Xenakis wrote for a solo violin, Mika and Mika S. They were both dedicated to his publisher, Mika Salabert. So, two short pieces, which I talk about in performing Xenakis.